Welcome to Voices of NCAJ. We're talking to members of the North Carolina Advocates for Justice about what it means to be a trial lawyer, what it takes to be great at the practice of law, and how being a part of NCAJ enriches their lives and careers. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome, everyone, to Voices of NCAJ, the podcast for the North Carolina Advocates for Justice. I am Amber Nimix, your host and Director of External Affairs for NCAJ. Before we get started, I'd like to thank our Circle of Leadership Gemstone Level members for supporting NCAJ's mission and this podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see a list of Circle of Leadership firms at the end. To find out how your firm can join the Circle, go to ncaj.com/circle. My guest today is Gretchen Engel. She retired this summer after 33 years at the Center for Death Penalty Litigation. That included a dozen as executive director. Gretchen has spent her decades at CDPL befriending and advocating for those the state has condemned to death, while educating politicians and lawmakers about the need to change laws that keep the death penalty in place in North Carolina. NCAJ has a long history of support for CDPL, which includes lobbying the legislature to found its predecessor, the North Carolina Resource Center, in the late 1980s, and continues today with ongoing financial support for CDPL from the NCAJ Foundation and the Allen E. Bailey Endowment. NCAJ has presented a CLE on death penalty issues for 25 years and counting. Gretchen's retirement happens to coincide with a surge of renewed interest in the death penalty litigation in North Carolina and in the United States in general. Gretchen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it, Amber, and appreciate NCAJ for many, many years of support.
Awesome. First of all, congratulations on your retirement. How does it feel to have stepped away from the office?
Well, I felt like it was the right time, but I love my job. I love the people I worked with, including my clients. It was very meaningful work, important work to be doing. And so, you know, it is a little strange to be in this place where I'm figuring out ways to have less intensity and less demands, but also continue community service dedicated to that and enjoying this time to figure out the new ways to do that.
Oh, great, great. So how did you first get involved in death penalty litigation work?
Well, I would say that when I came out of high school and college, the things that really motivated me that I wanted to work on were race and poverty. And so when I went to law school, I had some inkling that the death penalty was a place where those two things were very much intertwined. And so I went to Alabama to an office called the Alabama Resource Center. At that time, there were federally funded centers in what we called the Death Belt, primarily Southern, but also Midwestern states that were heavy users of the death penalty. And Brian Stevenson was the head of that office. He sent me down very quickly. I think I'd been there a week or two, sent me to death row, where I met a man named Jesse Morrison, who was an amazing person who had transformed himself in his more than a decade of incarceration. His case was rife with racism. And I drove home from that prison. The prison is in Holman. It's very near Monroeville, the setting of To Kill a Mockingbird. It's about an hour and a half back to Montgomery on I-65. And I think I might have cried almost the entire way home, just thinking about, I just met this person and the state wants to kill him. They want to put him in an electric chair and kill him. And it just kind of astounded me. And really, it was compelling. And of course, Brian's office was inspiring. And later I did another, after coming to North Carolina and doing an internship at Ferguson and Stein, I went back and did more death penalty work in Georgia during law school and then sat down with Brian Stevenson. And he said, you should go and work in North Carolina. Henderson Hill's the director there, and he's great. And there are people like Ken Rose, and there's a real community of defenders there. And that would be a good place for you. And he was right, as he is about so many things.
Great. And where did you grow up?
In the Great Lakes region, Minnesota, Wisconsin.
Okay.
There's no death penalty there. So there was no chance I was going to be doing this kind of work.
Okay.
Near my home.
And so your experience working with the Resource Center in Alabama, that was your first experience living and working in the South?
We had lived in Virginia when I was a kid near the West Virginia border, and I think we went to the Outer Banks in 1969.
Okay. But this was the first real experience with the effects of institutional racism.
Yeah. There was a Klan march 2 weeks after I got to Montgomery. There were bomb threats at Brian's office. You know, it was a serious place and a serious time.
And what year was this again?
91.
In 91, right.
It's a long time ago, but it's not that long ago, right?
Yeah, it doesn't. 91 is not 61.
Right.
Yeah. And so what year did you move to North Carolina?
92. I started my job on July 1st of 1992.
And so, I mean, you have like, we could talk for hours and hours about all the people that you've met and the cases that you've seen. What are some that have stuck with you most vividly through the years?
You're right. There are so many. I think what I would share with you is the experience of obtaining clemency for Robert Bacon in 2001. Governor Easley commuted his sentence. Robert was sentenced to death twice by all white juries, and we ended up having something like a 6 month long clemency campaign. And so many people, a lot of members of what was then the Academy for Trial Lawyers, assisted. We had a May 18th execution date. We managed to get a stay, and from the North Carolina Supreme Court, had oral argument that summer. We lost. We got a new execution date in September, and then September 11th happened. We got a two-week reprieve and a new execution date in October. And about a week and a half before that date, the governor's office called and said the governor was going to stop the execution and commute Robert's sentence. The key to that campaign was really educating the public about how the death penalty works and how racism had affected Robert's case. He was dating a white woman. She wanted him to help her kill her husband, who she was estranged from. He was also white. Robert was black. And we interviewed jurors who admitted that the fact that he was dating a white woman was pivotal to their decision to sentence him to death. And that we were able to get not just the North Carolina NAACP, but the local chapter down in the county where this case originated from. They had an event. There were op-eds. There were university students, law students, so many people who really took seriously this problems with the system and the racism in the case. And I will share just one other aspect of it. In any death penalty case, if you can, I have tried to reach out to family members of the victim. And in this case, Gerda Stein, who worked at our office for many, many years, she and I spent a couple of hours in the home of the mother of the man that Robert was convicted of killing. And she had lost so much. She had loved her son was married to the co-defendant. They had children together. So she felt the pain of her son's death, the betrayal by her daughter-in-law, really the loss of her grandchildren, who then went to live with the co-defendant's parents. And yet she did not harbor feelings of revenge or retribution in her heart and was willing to speak to the governor about her indifference to whether he was executed. That wasn't something she wanted or was going to make her life better. And it was very humbling, her generosity to us, that she was willing to sit down and speak with people that she could have easily had anger and hate for, justifiably, but she didn't. She had incredible humanity.
And this was not something that Governor Easley did a whole lot of. Is that correct?
No, and he actually, you know, personally prosecuted people as a district attorney and spoke often about those cases and how, yeah, they were really searing for him, I think. So this was the first of two. He only granted clemency twice, and he presided over a lot of executions, more than any other governor in our state or in the modern era.
And so this was a turning point in public opinion in the state to have such a pro-capital punishment governor change his mind and grant clemency in a case like this?
You know, that period was really a time when the media narratives were starting to change. When I came in the early 90s, every media story about the death penalty was, here's a really terrible crime, these are the gory facts, and here's the very sympathetic victim. And it was just, you like this person, you like this person. You know, it's not even a choice, right? And then in 2000, our office worked with reporters from the Charlotte Observer who did a big series on the death penalty. And they talked about drunk lawyers and lawyers who had no trial experience and real estate lawyers who were representing people at trial on death row. Somebody who had just gotten out of prison after being convicted of receiving child pornography. And these just sham trials with so many all-white juries and inept counsel, and also cases of favorable evidence being withheld by the prosecution. And so that series had happened. And it was kind of in that environment that we stepped in with Robert's case. And I think, you know, of course, having the governor of the state acknowledge, yes, there really are problems in this system, as, at least as exemplified in this case, was huge. And we did get a lot of attention for it. And I think it helped to start the public really thinking about how these cases are tried.
And so you had been at the Center for Death Penalty Litigation for 10, 12 years by about that time?
Nine.
Okay. So what was that like for you to have that, to see the work that you had been doing for so long, to have a victory like that?
It was great. I remember, I guess I got the call at home. I think my recollection is that Reuben Young, who was the assistant to the governor, who went on to later become a judge, that he called, and I rode my bike down to our office, was downtown, and I ran up seven flights of stairs and found Staples Hughes, who was then the appellate defender, and he was the first person I got to tell. So I had a lot of energy at that time. But it was huge, and it was huge for, there were so many people that helped with that effort. You know, the litigation in the North Carolina Supreme Court was part of it. There was the media part of it. There was the outreach to the jurors who had given us this critical information, to the victim's family, and of course to Robert himself and his mother. She's passed away now, but she used to call me 3-4 times a year and send me cards for years after we got clemency, and really had a great bond with her. She had one of the lawyers and me come to her church in Boston and meet members of her congregation that had supported her through that ordeal. So it was all really pretty amazing. And then Robert died a few years ago in prison, and Gerda and I were in touch with his sister. And, you know, these are human beings. And so you really do make these connections to people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what would you consider, in addition to the personal individual victories where you're able to save someone from being put to death, what would you consider to be CDPL's greatest successes during your tenure, sort of on an institutional level?
Sure. Well, I think we really helped to raise the quality and the expectations of the quality of counsel in these cases. Several of the people at CDPL were involved in different commissions that finally led to the creation of the Indigent Defense System, which is it's underfunded, but it's a much better system than the one that was appointing, you know, the people I talked about earlier, the drunk lawyers and the ex-felons and the completely inexperienced and unprepared. And so that was really important. And also paying lawyers. I remember Ken Rhodes had an appeal. He was paid $5 an hour for a capital appeal. So that was a huge thing, making it so that there was a mitigation investigator in all of our cases now, someone who really looks at the background of the client so that the jury really understands the decision they're making at the sentencing phase, the decision between life and death. Also, was always very proud that North Carolina banned the execution of people with intellectual disabilities before the U.S. Supreme Court outlawed that practice as a violation of the Eighth Amendment. And that was through creative litigation by our office. And Jonathan Brown was critical in that. Judge Standback was critical in that from Durham. In North Carolina, we've had more people removed from death row because of intellectual disabilities than any other state. We've been very successful with that litigation.
Yeah. And NCAJ, or the academy at that time, was instrumental in getting the laws changed.
Yes.
And in Bill Mills, I believe it was, he had the first case.
Yes.
I believe, where you got someone off of death row under that, under those new laws. So that was a long time coming, a long campaign.
Oh, yeah. Because I remember in the 90s when it was being debated in the legislature and that somebody suggested a bad amendment that would have really gutted the bill, and Marianne Talley calling and us saying, don't pass that. It won't do anything. And then it became this point where the U.S. Supreme Court was going to hear a case from North Carolina on this issue. And then Attorney General Roy Cooper, I think he did not want to be defending the practice of executing people with intellectual disabilities. So that and the certainly the academy was critical. And I was so privileged to be co-counsel with Bill Mills in the Skipper case. That was the first hearing to go, first case to go to hearing. And that was a wonderful victory. And Bill did just about everything in court. What an amazing lawyer he is and an amazing person. And then, of course, there's the Racial Justice Act, which has resulted in 4 people directly being removed from death row, from there really being a record of the racism and jury selection in capital cases in North Carolina, all over the state from 1990 to the present. And it's really that law that is the reason why we haven't had executions in nearly 20 years.
Wow. Yeah. Gosh. Well, we'll get to this in just a second. What are sort of greatest setbacks, I guess, would you say, then, as you look back on your 3 decades there?
Well, obviously, individual executions and cases that we thought were so meriting of clemency. So many bitter, bitter losses. Ilias Sirianni, who had killed his wife, all of his children begged for his life. A couple of them had witnessed the murder, and they were left orphans. The governor refused to grant clemency. Cases that we really should have won, deserved to win, many, many of those kinds of bitter losses. And to be honest, things have felt, I would say, in the last, certainly the last half of my career, that things were moving more slowly than I would have liked, but we're moving in the direction of we're going to get rid of this punishment. District attorneys are voting with their feet. They're not using it nearly as much as they did. I mean, when I came, we had 60 or 70 capital trials a year, and half of those resulted in death sentences. Over the last 10 years, I think we've averaged fewer than 1 death sentence a year. We have maybe 3 trials, 5 trials, capital trials in a year. Jurors are more reluctant to impose it because they've heard about cases of wrongful conviction. They know about the fallibility of the system.
How many people are on death row now in North Carolina?
It's a little over 120.
120. And when was the last time North Carolina executed someone?
August of 2006.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. But now, just of course, I'm sure you are well aware, the legislature recently in North Carolina enacted HB 307, which is committed to trying to speed up these cases and even is willing to explore incredibly barbaric methods of punishment. So that really feels like just really going in the wrong direction. And the timing, I had retired before this happened. It was kind of like, ooh, got out just in time, but also feeling like, I got a letter from a longtime client, and, he said that the people are very worried and very frightened about what's going to be coming in the future.
So what do you attribute this? It's been almost 20 years since anyone's been put to death in North Carolina by the state. And then all of a sudden this, we saw it happen, I guess, last year or the year before with South Carolina, like trying to get around the lethal injection, which was a practical means of helping slow, executions. That really, from just observing, that really helped stem the tide, because across the country, if you couldn't use this means, then you were stymied in actually putting it into play. And then you saw South Carolina employ the or try to employ the firing squad. And, you know, you just kind of looked at from over slightly north and thought, how could this be happening? And then all of a sudden this summer, it happened here. How do you make sense of that? Just like as a professional who's worked in this field for 30 years, 33 years.
Well, I mean, I think it's very easy for politicians who are of the mind to capitalize on fear and hatred. It's really easy. You know, these are primal emotions that people have. And when you have a video of a beautiful young woman who's came here from another country striving to have a better life, and she's brutally murdered on film by someone who looks frightening, who's African-American, and it's on public transportation where anybody could be, that is just, it's like pouring gasoline on a fire. And I think it's very difficult for people to think rationally. You know, unfortunately, I think what I understand from the news reporting is that, you know, initially the legislators were working in good faith to try to really think about what are things we can put in place that actually would be helpful. And do we need to look at pretrial release, or do we need to look at how we treat the mentally ill? But then, of course, there were these last minute amendments that, you know, in my view, are pure demagoguery. They have nothing to do with offering real solutions. And so it's a very sad, and I think the backdrop is what you pointed out. I mean, it's happening in South Carolina. Alabama is using nitrogen gas. I think there's another state that was going to use the firing squad. And there's just a general coarsening and sharpening of political division in the country and just a lot of angry people. And so I think it's that environment that this kind of stuff, but it really does feel like the 90s all over again. And the pendulum's always swinging back and forth, of course.
So what effect do you think that this legislation will have on the actual implementation of the death penalty? What effect do you think this will have on the actually whether or not the death penalty gets used again in our state?
Well, it's always hard to know. In 1996, after the Oklahoma City bombing, federally, there was national legislation that was designed to speed up appeals in federal court. And I remember being at a seminar back then, and of course, everybody was really depressed about it. But there were also people who said, every time the legislature tries to do something and they overreach and they pass these extreme measures in response to extreme crimes, we get more opportunities to litigate, and it kind of backfires. And so could that happen here? Possibly. You know, it's interesting that the legislature, which is controlled by the same party that is in charge of the North Carolina Supreme Court, in some ways kind of really went after the court for why are you taking so long to process these cases? Well, it's because it takes a while to get a transcript. And then there's actually appellate rules about how many days you get to prepare your brief. And it's not unreasonable or unexpected that sometimes people are going to say, something came up in my life and I need a little extra time. And my opposing counsel says it's okay. They're okay with giving me another 30 or 60 days. So, you know, and there's always the balance of when you try to speed things up, does that then risk or increase the risk you're going to execute an innocent person? Yeah, it does. Henry McCollum was on death row for 30 years. He was innocent. And when his case was early in the process, Justice Antonin Scalia wrote a bitter opinion talking about what a horrible case Henry McCollum's case was, and that he was basically the poster child for why we needed the death penalty. And all this time, he wasn't the person who did it. So there's really trade-offs to be made. This is it's a human endeavor, and people make mistakes, and whether they're ill-intentioned or not, we need to do these things carefully, and there's a reason that there's all these safeguards put in place. I don't think they're sufficient. I think you'd be better off just junking the whole project and have life without parole as our most serious punishment. But assuming you don't want to do that, you at least got to do it right.
Right. So one recent development that didn't get as much press as the passage of the legislation this summer was Governor Cooper's commutation of a record number of death penalty sentences when he left office, I guess the beginning of 2025. Gosh, was it?
It was his last day. It was the last day in office, December 31st. Uh-huh. Yeah.
December 31st. It seems like a million years since December 31st, 2024.
We've all aged a lot in the last 9 months, believe me. Yeah, that was a big day.
Mm-hmm. What was obviously, I think it was in the 20s, right? It was a
15.
15. So that was obviously a tremendous victory for all of those individuals. And a statement for or against the death penalty, what kind of impact does that have on in terms of where we of the political case for or against the death penalty?
Well, that was huge. We never had a single day where 15 people got relief. Years ago, there was a North Carolina case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court that ultimately resulted in resentencing hearings for more than 50 people. But, you know, those all played out over the course of years and some people got death again. But this, you know, 15 people, you can turn in your red jumpsuit, we're done, was incredible. And I got to go to Central Prison that day and talk to clients who had received clemency. And it was huge for our office. CDPL represented 11 of the 15. And I think there were two things that struck me about it. One is that I feel like the governor really took the review of the cases seriously. And to have a governor say, I find significant enough problems in 15 cases where the jury has already made its decision. And in most cases, the courts had reviewed the case at least once. It's a serious indictment of the system that executive clemency would be warranted, that the governor would exercise that power. And also, I guess I think I was surprised that there wasn't more backlash to it. And that contributed to my feeling that 2025 is the time to retire, right? Up here on the high ground. It would have been great if he cleared the whole row, then I really could have ridden off into the sunset. But you know, there were a few news stories, there were a few little areas of the state where there was some grumbling. But generally, I think it was all consistent with what I was talking about earlier, that we were just moving in the direction of slowly getting rid of the death penalty. And so then to have, you know, this recent step, which we don't know what the result will be. You never know.
So how do you feel as you ride off, I guess, not into the sunset, but as you step back and, you know, pass the torch on to the next generation of leadership, how do you feel like the table is set for the challenges that lie ahead?
Well, a little bit torn, as I talked about at the beginning, that, you know, not being right there in the middle of the fight as I have been for so long. But the leadership and the staff at CDPL is just outstanding. I mean, that was certainly a factor in my decision to retire, that I knew that our interim director, Sheila Kenny, was incredible and will be a very powerful and effective leader. We have a lot of great young lawyers. We also have Janine Fedor, who was at the Appellate Defender's Office when I got here. She had finished law school in 91. She's at CDPL. So there is definitely some seasoned leadership there, as well as a lot of new, enthusiastic, really talented investigators and attorneys and our professional staff. It's just a wonderful group of people who is now representing, I think, it's about 2/3 or 3/4 of the row at this point. And that over time, that number has changed, you know, how much of the representation is by CDPL. And, you know, I think in some ways it's better when there's a lot more members of the private bar involved, that it shouldn't be, you know, this one group of people that can easily be labeled as zealots, right? If it's a broader segment, and certainly a lot of NCAJ lawyers over the years have been involved in these cases. But that sort of goes back to another point we were talking about, is that in my 30 plus years, the hourly rate in capital cases went up $15 an hour. So it's less than 50 cents a year. And so a lot of people can't really do it. And that's a problem as well. And if the legislature really wants to speed these cases up, they've got to make sure that the statutory entitlement to two lawyers is met. And I know there are people who don't have two lawyers because there just aren't enough people to take them.
Yeah, it's there's a lot that goes into a legislative solution. Yeah, definitely. Well, Gretchen, thank you so much.
Sure.
For your service over the years and your leadership and for being a guest on the podcast today.
Well, it's been a pleasure. It's great to have a conversation with you, Amber. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, we wish you the best and we hope that you have a very enjoyable retirement. And we know that we'll be hearing more from you about this or other issues. I'm sure that you probably won't be terribly quiet in your...
Probably not. That might be a safe bet.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Before we go, I would like to thank today's episode sponsor, Advocate Capital. Advocate is passionate about helping plaintiffs' attorneys get better results for their clients, mainly through their AdvoTrack case expense funding service. It allows firms to track case expenses and recover borrowing costs, which makes the net costs of borrowing zero on cases they win. You can learn more at advocatecapital.com. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And if you are watching on YouTube, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any episodes of Voices of NCHA.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Voices of NCHA. For more information on the North Carolina Advocates for Justice and how to join or support NCHA, please visit our website at www.ncaj.com.